a two-part series of hip-hop and the spread of Islam.
Assalamu alaikum. I have been interested in coming to this class for some time. I've been discussing it for a while. And I was kind of excited when he decided that the class was ready for this. I wasn't quite sure what he meant by that, but I'm sure that you guys will probably know better than I will. There is a subject that I've been involved in and feel really excited about, and that's the subject of Islam and hip-hop music. Although we'll cover a broad base of music and its influences today, it's a very, very hot property right now throughout academia and in many other locations around the world because of the influence of hip-hop, and it's managing to permeate the ideas of mainstream culture all around the world. And there was one comment that was made to me about if it was actually hip-hop and the spread of Islam, or was it the spread of Islam and hip-hop? The two are different, but very interesting subject matter. I felt that any topic we're going to discuss relative to music and Islam, there's almost two elements you cannot avoid. One is whether or not the music is even considered a halal haram in Islam. And two, what are the forces behind Islam in music that's caused it to permeate societies around the world the way that it has? And my thoughts about those two, I felt it imperative to at least on a cursory basis cover some of the aspects of music and Islam from its perspective of being considered haram. And if you're going to do that, you've got to address some of the issues of the Salafi or the Sufis and their movements. And I wanted to just touch on that because I'm sure there's a lot more to be said as we go into the subject about Islam and more like popular music as opposed to the current situation. So I wanted to just spend a little time addressing that issue. I have some slides over here.
On the overhead, kind of make some of that note-taking a little easier for you so you can all get good grades on that exam, that test, that paper that I talked about. Hopefully this stuff will come out okay. Can you read that? Okay.
What I wanted to do was to kind of just give some ideas. There are very few madhabs you're going to find that's going to tell you in any way remotely that music in Islam, particularly pop music in Islam, is okay. Almost everyone's voice you hear is going to say it's haram. And without taking a position on that myself, I decided to do a little research, present some opinions that might give you an objective idea to make some conclusions regarding how there are various people who can, you know, go into this industry and work within this industry and even thrive within this industry without necessarily performing haram acts. And you'll see as it goes into some of the things that we're talking about here, if this music or this entertainment or this form of, I'll say expression, and in most cases it should be a form of expression of Allah, your sincerity in pleasing Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, that you will allow yourself to get involved or to enjoy this medium without necessarily getting involved in those things about the medium that it may be negative. And it's important because when you look at certain expressions of music, you'll find that there are certain illicit things that you know obviously are not good. However, if you're able to withstand those things and they don't necessarily send you the other way, they don't cause you to get yourself involved in those acts, it's almost as if it's a non-event. It's more of a haram if it causes you to get involved in some of the things that may or may not be approved, forbidden, or haram in themselves. So there's a school of thought that if the activity itself or the music itself does not cause you to act in a way that may be haram, then it's permissible. So you'll see this throughout the overheads as I move them along. So in this one here, you can see where he's talking about entertainment, which may comfort the soul and please the heart, refresh the ears, singing, yet it doesn't cause you any harm or to act in any negative way or in a harmful way, in a way that may be forbidden or wrong.
You'll find that as you go through these overheads, and as I said, a way to kind of keep your notes easy for you, you'll see that they follow a certain pattern. You know, these inevitably will deal primarily with Sufism because that's the one aspect of Islam that's pretty open to it and kind of celebrates it throughout many of the different aspects of the Salafi. You have different hadiths that's been put forward that imply that music was acceptable, at least in a limited form, from hadiths that we mentioned here. There's others as well that gives an example of this. And I wanted to present these just so you have an idea of the fact that there are arguably several hadiths that does suggest that music might be okay. You know, it's not intended to make you think that, you know, you can go out and listen to anything on the air and feel good about it. That's not it at all. But there are some suggestions that perhaps music in a certain form that might inspire you to worship Allah, to help you to cleanse your soul or to move you along in that aspect may in fact be helpful. So, you know, it causes you some objectivity that in some minds and in some schools of thought around the world, there isn't even the slightest crack of objectivity. There isn't even a possibility in some cases that music could be remotely considered to be okay or prohibited, or not prohibited in any sense. I have, by the way, I have all these available for you. If you want them, I can provide you with copies of all this stuff. We have another group of hadiths here that deals with some of the celebrations during the Eid, where the Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, had said to Aisha that perhaps there were friends among the Ansar who were having a party, and suggested that
maybe she would send over someone to sing, provide entertainment for them. And if in fact these hadiths are not da'if, they're sincere and they're strong and they can be accounted on, and you can pretty much rely on the ideas that perhaps in a limited form music is okay or was okay. And as I said, I'm not arguing that position, I'm just trying to open your minds to it, because as we move this along, you'll see quite quickly that there's a lot of music out there by so-called Muslims that I wouldn't in any way assume would be considered halal at all. But you have several other hadiths here that I wanted to bring your attention to. Now, one of the things that we move into now
with regards to music being haram was whether or not that music will cause you to act in a way that might be prohibited. And this is some of the guidelines that were given along with those hadiths for
the things that you might be concerned about if in fact you are going to delve into this area of music. And he lists them as: subject matter of the songs must be in accordance with the teaching of Islam. Subject matter of the song may not be against Islam. Listening to singing music should not be done in excess or extravagance. An individual is the best judge of himself, and a person finds that him or her listening to the certain singing of music arouses one's passions and leads him or her towards sin and dull spirituality, then he should avoid it. So it's pretty clear that there are some argument, at least, that some aspects of music might even be good. And again, that's kind of reasons why you use the Sufi movement as one to kind of signify that, because it's so much a part of the way in which they worship.
And it continues here.
And I wanted to make a note here. As you can see in the bottom here, the comments that are made are very important. The above hadith shows that listening to music and singing when it is accompanied by something that is haram, such as drinking alcohol, is in itself haram. So it's not just a matter of listening to the music and what it may actually incite within you, but what it may actually cause you to do. So then you may have some extenuating circumstances if music causes you to do other things, causes you to act out in another way that may not be directly related to something that you heard in the music or something that the music had said but may have caused you to do. So each of us are all our own best judges of those things. But What these do is they try to establish the fact that, you know, there was an opening there for music to be heard. And again, you're going to, I'm going to try to hold the questions until then, okay? But Mark, so these are just some of the things I wanted to touch on briefly, because I know there's a lot more that I want to get into regarding popular music and what it's all about. And as again, we go into
popular music and some of the ideas that he's always put forth, and being one of the prominent Sufi sheikhs, it's important that we embrace some of the ideas and thoughts that he has, that he's put forward.
He has always been one who's tried to establish that you find yourself in your nearness to God through your pursuit of God. And whatever it is that allows you to embrace that and to enhance that, they're trying to encourage you to do. For that reason, you have certain elements of the Sufi practice that are regulated and guided by a specific person, the sheikh, for instance. And among the whirling dervish, you have all types of I'll say, established ideologies that kind of feed into and out of one finding themselves. And it's really kind of synonymous with all of our journeys into Islam. It's an individual thing. It's one of the beauties of Islam is that it's you and Allah. You know, it's not you and five other people. You're responsible for your actions on this earth, and you'll carry them on with you. And you have the opportunities to better yourselves at every turn, and it's incumbent upon you to do that. What they try to do is create an environment that allows you to do that. And music is a very, very important element in their practice of the deen. You have here Ghazali saying that music is not put into the heart what is not already there, but instead it makes manifest what is already dormant in the heart. Those are things that we're all subject to at all times. And if music causes us to stir that emotion, whatever it may be, good or bad, then there's something that has to do with you either purging it if it's bad, or liberating it if it's good, and allowing it to free you and draw you nearer to God. So you have all these things as part of the Sufi practice and part of the dervish elements. You have the use of instrumentation, something which, if in fact music was haram in Islam, there would be no need for instruments. Only the need for instruments is ripple light. It's going to cause music. So without taking a position, you have these situations that would at least allow you to understand the argument. Here Ghazali says that purely religious use of music and dancing, such as that of the Sufis, who by this means stir themselves toward good or love towards Allah, their heart becoming in this condition as clean as silver in the flame of a furnace, and attaining a degree of purity that could never be attained by any amount of mere outward austerities. You don't have to wear the woolen cloak or the Sufi dresses, it's commonly referred to. It's what's in your heart and what comes out of your heart. And it's clear that music in the Sufi tradition takes on elements that are very akin to that of any other system of music, that is.
You have the instrumentation that occurs, and I'll present this to you to kind of give you an idea of what I'm saying.
You have the manner in which the dhikr is done, the incantation, the vocalization. You have the instrumentation that takes place as well. You have the sheikh who kind of leads and controls the dhikr and the dervish. It's more like the conductor of the musical piece, if that's what you want to call it. Now, I'm only relating this to you so you can get a better concept of what it is without saying that's what it is. You have a lot of things that would be akin to music that would be heard or seen or viewed anyplace else. And again, the example used here is if you had walked into a situation where you saw this going on, you may think that you were in a jam session of some sort.
have music. Here are the types of instruments that are used during some of the presentations that you will find that very akin to the dhikr ceremonies that occur with the Sheikh, with the Sufis. You have the ney, or a flute. You have a kanun, which is a type of trapezoid. The oud is a violin type instrument, and of course there's drums. So you definitely have instrumentation. And with that in mind, there has to be some consideration given for the place of music in Islam. And the reason why I do that is because we can't embrace the idea of Islam and music, or music in Islam, without having a place for it. And though we've established that there is a place for it because it's practiced all the time, every day, that legitimately there are reasons for it, and there are hadiths that may even support it. The reason for the dhikr is, as we said, to bring the subject closer to Allah. These are some of the tenets behind the dhikr that the Sufis practice that brings us into a frame of mind of being near to Allah, where they get so enraptured in what they're doing that they don't even want to be distracted for the slightest moment, disturbed in any way. There have been examples of people who have gone into convulsions, people who have lost limbs, many different things that have occurred while they're involved in the dervish, the action of the dervish, while they're going through dhikr, that we wouldn't have any conscious idea of being able to assimilate in our society, here in America. We are not familiar with that type of a thing. We call it worldly dervish because we have no better description of it, and it's something that's been called that for years, although it's probably the furthest thing from the truth. It's a spiritual state that many of us seek to reach every day. They just have to find a way, they have to find a way that benefits them and that they can utilize it. It kind of transfers that energy to them, for them to look inside themselves and find the best in their hearts and their soul. So you see that there's reason for the dhikr. And I go into this because it ultimately comes back to us searching to find ourselves. And as Muslims, that's something that we do each day. We're striving to be the best person we can be.
We're striving to try to lead that life that would be acceptable to Allah, that will get us into the akhirah, and hopefully allow us to strive on this earth while we're here and to be the best person we can. And basically what it comes out is that when you draw this nearness out of your heart in approaching to Allah and is embraced by Allah, then you have a way to speed yourself on to embracing Allah's will for you in this world. And upon that, you will then begin to realize your mortality and to try to strive for the better things on this earth and to try to do the things on this earth that you can, so that when you go into the hereafter, your right hand will outweigh your left with your good deeds as opposed to your bad deeds, realizing that whatever it is that you have will be your due regardless. These citations that we have here from the various publications are those that kind of remind you that in researching these things, there are a lot of opinions. The ones I presented to you here are just opinions, and they're just presenting this particular point of view. There are thousands of others, and I don't intend to take any one of those. I'm here to just objectively have a discourse with you regarding music and Islam. So these things are all part of what we do as Muslims each day, and hopefully we're all striving toward that and reaching it. Finally, this is kind of the culmination of what the authors and the researchers that I've delved into regarding the Sufi movement and music concluded. They felt that there was one unifying thing that emerged. That was knowing God through worship while accepting the practice of the various acts of faith that leads an individual to development, and those practices are intended to be followed in order to bring nearness to God. Part of that was the practice of the dhikr. It's their tool, and I won't say their tool, it's our tool. It's a tool that can be used. I have friends of mine who get involved in dhikr, who actually practice it with a group of Muslims, but they're not Muslims, and they enjoy it. There's a movement afoot now for many of us to try to take the consequences of our actions for the lack of outreach, the lack of extending our hands to others, and understanding that there's a lot of very good and useful literature, books, there are a lot of good speeches, there are a lot of good materials, documents available to all of us that would break down some of the barriers of our understanding, that would allow us as Muslims to communicate more thoroughly and effectively with others, and at the same time to grow as people. We have an opportunity to utilize the Sufi movement for the good that it provides to a lot of people. The translations of Rumi has touched lots of people that are not just Muslim, and that if we were to try to break down some of the barriers that we have of communication, that we have of relating to people outside of our own little shells and operating within a certain sphere as Muslims and not operating more in terms of being people, that we could actually do more dawah. We could do more good. We could promote more understanding and do less, do more to lessen the intolerance and the bigotry, the anti-Semitism, and the various things that we have that we face each day. And it's something that we have to start to take a look at. You know, that all of the madhabs have their different variations of what they do, but in reality, we're all human. We're all people, and it's just one human race. And if there's ways that we can break down some of those barriers and communicate with others, then we should do that. And music is probably the one unifying factor that does that. And for the Sufis, it's something that they utilize to free themselves and bring them nearer to God. From there, I wanted to get into more of the modern music and some of the ideas of how it's permeated modern-day society, and also how it's gone into a position where you can now look at a television commercial and you can see a commercial where you'll have Nelly doing a hip-hop commercial with a guy 60 years old about a Chevrolet. You can have senior citizens, 80 years old, women, men, Asian, Latino, doing commercials from Boost Mobile Home with the jargon of today. Hip-hop music. Hip-hop language. The verbiage is totally foreign to those folks. And there's no way you're going to get into the subject of Islam and music in America particularly, and the state that it's in today, without dealing with Islam and its rise in the inner city. The reason why I suggest that to you is because as we've moved into this idea of music and Islam, we know fairly well that most of the madhabs outside of Sufis really don't. They don't really accept music as being a form that's acceptable or permissible in Islam. I touched on it only because I wanted to establish the fact that there are areas that can be used and have been done and is currently being done. When you start talking about the Sunni Muslim, you start talking about the Nation of Islam, the 5% Nation of Islam, the Natawabans, the Black Moors, Black Hebrews, all variations of Islam, and there's a lot of others outside of that. You will find that a majority of those people who are involved in the hip-hop movement currently are people who are of those faiths, but primarily of the 5% Nation of Islam. And to go into that, we've got to kind of get some background on where it came from and how it began. And as you see, the rise of Islam in America was basically an outshoot from the times in which society wasn't quite as kind to the minorities. There was always a question of unemployment, always a question of racial bias and prejudice. There's always problems of housing. There were times when there was blacks didn't have the right to vote. You know, so we're talking about situations that here in America were very dire. And those consequences that we all had to live with from those times caused us to be hardened in certain ways and caused us also to be experienced in certain ways. A lot of those things that we have gone through throughout that time in America, you find that a lot of the immigrant Muslims are going through today. It's it's kind of sad, but the lessons that we've learned through integration or racism, however it may be, still permeate society. You know, it may never end, but we have it, and it's going to be with us. So get used to it, learn how to address it, and learn how to thrive under it. African Americans have been doing it for years, but we had no choice. You know, we didn't have a country to go back to. But you can see that hip hop, as it was initially established, came out of a part of society that wasn't of the mainstream. It stems from things that typically were, it came from the underground. And if you can understand that hip hop came from the underground, you've got a pretty good idea of what it's all about. It wasn't mainstream. If anything was mainstream, it was counter hip hop. Hip hop was the anti-everything. And it was anti-commercial, anti-liberal, anti-conservative. It was counter everything. And that's a good thing, because this identity came out of those people who were disenfranchised and disillusioned by everything they saw around them. Basically, you're talking about the X generation who were the kids of the baby boomers. And what I'm saying is, those same conditions that we had as baby boomers somehow managed to secretly make its way back to the same sort of conditions, the same set of circumstances, the same type of environment that exists today with the hip-hoppers. So the baby boomers, babies, ex-geners, basically had the same situations we had. Now, you know, we had I'm speaking of my own age group, I happen to be over 50, civil unrest. We had strikes, boycotts, pickets. We had all those same elements, unemployment, dissatisfaction with the educational system, anti-big boss, you know, the establishment, big business, the system. We were against the system. You know, as a result of that, we had our own ethic, you know. I'm going to get into some of these things and make some more comparisons to that, and you'll see them as how acute they are. But there was a time when Islam represented something more to African Americans. African Americans, by virtue of some of the teaching of Edward Lydon and Muhammad Ali Deuce, managed to find Islam as a way for them to uplift themselves, to find some pride in themselves, to establish an economic platform for themselves to thrive and to live in. It allowed them a way that they could find value in something within themselves that had been foreign to them prior to that time. When you're raised in a country that, you know, you're considered 3/5 of a man and don't have the right to vote, it's very demeaning. So when you're able to find a way to pull yourself up by your bootstraps, it becomes something that rallies innately within anybody who has been among the downtrodden. It's a very common thread today among the downtrodden. You can have a certain ideology, a certain philosophy that from now on will always appeal to the downtrodden. And there was a time when this advent of this new religion and this new way of life, this Deen of Islam that came to us, brought us this power that we felt. And it's transformed itself in many ways, and even more apparent today. And that's the reason why you have so many different variations of Islam within the African-American community, and many offshoots within the African-American community, and why it also is reflected in the music. Because there is a wide area of thought. There is no uniform, unilateral idea among African Americans that this is what we think, this is what we feel, this is what we believe. It's no different than any other community or any other race of people. They're all types. But you have an author, Edward Blythe, who was responsible for depicting, perhaps the first time in a liberal sense, why Islam was good for African Americans. And he took the time to analyze the benefits of the Deen of Islam would actually enhance you in so many ways, provide you with that outreach, that third thirst for knowledge that we search for, that we all are, is coming upon us as Muslims. The economic system, it provides us with a role for the male in the family to establish himself, to be responsible. It provides a clear-cut role for the female in the family. It provides for a system of welfare and taking care of ourselves and those around us. And it alleviates all the trappings of self-hatred that was synonymous with racism.
And we come into an area where Deuce Muhammad Ali, who is probably the best, most widely unknown, I'll say, influencer, for the lack of a better word,
perhaps in African-American history. The reason being is he was the mentor and he was the motivator for many of the African-American leaders, from Marcus Garvey to, you name it, Elijah Muhammad. His influence today is felt all throughout the world because of all the achievements and accomplishments in the direction that he gave African-Americans that allowed them to thrive. The platforms we were allowed to put forward, the ideas we had to conquer, to defeat racism, and how those ideas and those strategies are being used today. Black is beautiful, and having pride in yourself, to how now you can see the Africans in Africa saying those same things, you know? How this movement led to the apartheid movement in South Africa and overturned the entire government, and how that same cry